inside. What would he have said if that had been Devon? He would never say anything, though. He never did. But did he stow it away? Did they both have their little storage lockers of parental missteps and near catastrophes? Katie, he said now with a hollow look in his eyes that rattled her. This is the best thing. If something happened to Devon, you'd never forgive yourself. It ended with the slamming of doors and Katie shouting like she hadn't since she was a teenager, a hoarse and howling thing. Eric kept shaking his head, his face white, eyes like two pinholes. What makes you think you know better? She finally asked, voice shredded. You! And the word itself like a charge, a long-buried indictment. But all he said was, Katie, I'm fixing things. I have to fix this.
You can stay in here, Mom, Drew said, his bed heavy with books. I don't mind.
So she sat with him while he read, stopping every few minutes to tell her things until she warned him to rest his sweet voice.
Boy, at Thunrise, it must be like diving into cotton candy, Drew read. Mom, didn't you sell cotton candy when you were young?
I did, yes. That's how I met your dad. At the Kiwanis Fair. She had sold him fried clams on a paper plate and a twist-tie bag of cotton candy. And they spent that summer careening through back roads with sixers of Keystone. He loved to kiss the round scar on her eyebrow. The one from the time her stepdad caught her with the wiffle bat he carried when he was drinking. Eric loved to run his hand along the fight like a girl tattoo, wringing her left thigh. 1,000 years ago. The door opened. She could hear the zipping and unzipping of duffel bags, the shushing of Velcro grips, Eric and Devon shuttling back and forth, grabbing wristbands, liquid bandage spray, flip-flops, a jiggling pair of ankle braces, a tower of leotards. As if she were going to a major tournament, rather than to Gwen's pleasure palace a few blocks away. Devon stealing nervous glances at her through the doorway. From the upstairs window she watched as Devon walked outside, bag swung over her shoulder. Gwen was leaning against the car door, saying something to Eric, as Devon slipped into the front passenger seat. Lacey had already moved to the back. That night felt lonely in a way she hadn't known since childhood. The endless chain of evenings with a TV tray and waxy sleeve of crackers, peanut butter jar, her mom working late. Drew asleep in his room, she and Eric passing each other silently. For most of the evening, he sat at his computer, working with headphones on. She couldn't tell if he felt guilty or righteous. She missed Devon. And the energy around Devon being there, which felt elemental to everything, as if Devon's presence, quiet and focused, generated everything, in some way powered the house, the family. She only realized it now because everything else had stopped.
Nearly 9 o'clock, and she was drinking vinegary wine she'd found buried in the back of the refrigerator behind a jug of bubbling kefir.
She tried to stop her mind from turning and overturning images of Gwen's house. She had seen it at parties, a half dozen over the years. All the sconces and gilt and high ceilings of powder blue plaster, the study's lacquered walls, the curved-backed sofas, the fresh flowers fogging your mouth as you passed through. The marble-topped kitchen island, where platters of food always sat, mounds of olives, impossibly green artichokes, dewy lemons, everything wet and ready all the time. In the backyard, there was even a secret garden, enclosed by pear trees, latticed flat, candelabra-style, into a trellis, trained with the same rigor as Gwen trained Lacey's hair, planting her daughter between her legs in the stands as she flattened that white blonde hair into the tight Dutch braid, smoothing the feather wisps at her hairline hourly during meets.
Sometimes even Lacey seemed hand-manufactured, face cast in porcelain.
That tiny nose that tilted up at the end, as if Gwen herself had pinched it daintily, like a pie crust, right down the center. When the phone rang and Devon's name flashed there, Katie's body shook to life.
Mom, Devon said, I'm staying in one of the guest rooms. It's bigger than our whole upstairs.
Well, Katie said, I'm glad. The sheets smell funny, though, she said. Not like home.
There was a brief silence.
Mom, it's just a few days. I feel okay here. I do.
A pause.
Mom, are you there? Mom, I'm sorry.
Chapter 13. It's in here, in the bed with me. I see it. Hair and teeth against her ankles, something gnashing, something furred and champing, the rasping of hooves and nails. One of those night terrors she hadn't had since she was 6 years old, sleeping on that pull-out sofa with her mom.
It's here, help me, please, someone!
Her mother always laughing at the someone, saying, "How come you never ask for help from me?" Devin used to have them too back in kindergarten, clutching her sherbet-striped comforter, distraught, inconsolable. Katie had nearly forgotten what they felt like until... I see it in the bed! Sheets torn away, her palms white and spread on the bare mattress. Katie! Katie! Wake up! It was Eric, leaning in the darkened doorway, beer bottle in hand, looking at her. Wake up! In the violet dark of 2 a.m., he remade the bed for her, yanking the sheets back across the rumpled mattress pad. I can't sleep, he said. Then he went downstairs again. You were mysterious to him, and he was mysterious to you. She could hear him walking, floors creaking, the refrigerator opening and closing, the chime from his laptop, the hiss of his phone. She swore she could hear everything. Devin had been gone less than 2 days, and the house felt haunted. The decaying manse of a family quarantined by fever. Without car duty, practices, there was suddenly so much time, and Katie ended up spending far too long with Drew's sickbed meals, fashioning a banana to look like a person with raisin eyes, cutting his sandwich into angel wings. You really only learn your place, her mother once said, when you're left in it. She had talked to Devin on the phone 4 times, each time a minute or less. Devin off to special air floors and ballet bars and the 30-foot inflatable tumbling strip in Gwen's home gym. Katie hadn't talked to Eric at all. Are you going to be mad at me forever? Eric asked, coming up behind her as she dressed in the morning. He put his hands on her hips and ducked his head down against the top of her hair, and she felt an unexpected shiver. I'm sorry, he said. I'm sorry. But then he added, leaving for work. Katie, it's the right thing, I swear. Something was wrong. Wronger than it even seemed, she just wasn't sure what it was.
I'm better, Mom,
Drew said, 7 a.m., leaning over his terrarium, peering in the resin cave the salamander liked to hide in.
Okay,
she said, her hand on his forehead, no longer the little radiator of days before. But better isn't well.
Remember when we watched that show about cavefish?
He asked, tapping on the resin with one red finger. I think so.
They have scars where their eyes should be.
Right, because of evolution. It's always dark. They don't need to see.
Mrs. Teether said it's not true,
Drew said, lifting his head from the terrarium, a slurpy snail curled on his wrist.
They did this experiment where they mated the fish with other fish from different caves, and then the baby fish could see. Their eyes were bigger, and they could see everything.
Is that so? She said. Sometimes she wondered how she'd gotten such a smart kid, and just how smart he might be.
Mom, it was the cave's fault, not the fish.
His voice shook slightly, and she knew he must still be sick, emotional.
The cave made them that way.
But it still doesn't matter. They don't need to see down there, baby, she said, touching his forehead again. There's nothing to see.
It must have been weird the first time they saw their parents,
he said, peering closely at the snail on his wrist. His eyes glassed.
But their parents still couldn't see them.
I think you still have a fever.
Mom, what was Dad doing in the backyard?
He asked, coaxing the snail up his speckled forearm. She looked at him.
Dad?
He just left for work.
No, in the nighttime, last night, before the newspaper came.
What was he doing? He shrugged.
Talking on his phone? I saw the light on his cheek. He kept spinning around, talking. Who was he talking to?
The hydraulic drill of the landline startled her.
Katie, this is Helen Beck, Ryan's mom.
Oh, Helen.
Yes.
Are you okay?
I'm so sorry. I heard about what happened between Haley Belfour and your daughter.
Yes, Katie said.
Thank you. Devin's okay. I'm at Ryan's apartment, taking care of things.
She let out a weighty sigh.
You should see how many t-shirts he has. They all smell like him.
And then she said,
Katie, I think you should come here.
Pardon?
Well, it's... I think you should come over, if you can.
Do you think you can do that?
It's easier in person.
There was a pause, Katie looking at Drew, who was drinking a tall glass of flat ginger ale with a leisurely grace.
Oh, I remember this one.
Helen's voice came soft.
The gray ringer. He used to wear this back in high school whenever he played baseball.
That's 3:46, Mom, Drew croaked from the back seat, posted in his damp hand. Is this where Ryan lived?
She stopped at the box-shaped low-rise buildings on the right, just past the quick mark. Concrete walls, two sets of balconies, a banner across the facade. Affordable rentals. Call today.
Yes.
She'd gotten in the car within 10 minutes of Helen's call, had not stopped to think, or even to ponder the wisdom of taking Drew outside. Helen met them at the door, the buzzer broken.
He was working really hard, saving up, Helen said as they walked inside.
The hallway's linoleum cluttered with circulars, tinted takeout menus, a waterlogged stack of aging yellow pages.
He would have been out of here soon.
It looks fine, Katie said.
Hey, devil boy,
Helen said, winking down at Drew. She looked over at Katie.
Ryan used to get funny rashes like that all the time when he was little. He always told me it was my detergent, no matter which one I used. And never believed me.
They climbed the staircase, Drew's eyes jumping. His first time in an apartment building.
This is where Ryan lived?
Drew asked. Inside it looked like anyone's apartment, any young person living paycheck to paycheck. Small and sunstruck, everything in it beige and worn. With the same foam sofas, the microfiber shiny with age, the halogen torchere, the set of acrylic bar stools along the kitchen counter that were in all furnished rentals, everywhere. But there were little things that made it personal. A gently broken-in baseball cap on the glass-topped coffee table. A weaver's wagon apron hooked forlornly on a molded plastic coat stand. A windbreaker, faded red, hanging over the back of the sofa. Katie had seen Ryan wear it a half-dozen times. She didn't see his jean jacket. She guessed why.
Their eyes have 2,000 lenses,
Drew said, pointing toward a half-eaten blondie, its plastic wrap folded back, resting on the kitchen counter.
They can see everything.
What, devil boy?
Helen asked, winking at Katie.
They all watched as a cockroach scuttled across the counter and down the sink drain.
We only have one lens,
he said a little wistfully.
Oh, dear,
Helen said, walking over and squinting down the drain.
I saw a critter yesterday, too. Well...
There was a brief pause, then Katie couldn't wait any longer.
So you wanted to talk?
In the bedroom, Helen looked over at Drew.
Maybe we can put the TV on for Big Red.
Later, many times, Katie would remember the room's particular smell. Sweat and must. And forest pine from the little tree air freshener hanging from the blinds cord. And something else, something intimate, bodily. She looked down at the deep blue sheets coiled on the mattress, which sat on the floor exotically, summoning up bohemian memories of youth. A youth like Katie dreamed up as a girl, beaded curtain doorways and those technicolor saint candles in glass jars. There was no furniture other than that mattress and a table lamp on the floor, an open book beside it, its red cover bent back. She wondered if it was the novel he'd always kept in his back pocket. She found herself wanting to touch it.
She hadn't known him at all, really, but that made it sadder somehow. He had his trouble,
Helen was saying. But he was figuring things out. He finally had a steady job. Still couldn't afford cable or a cell phone. You try to help, but they don't want their mom's help, do they? He had his own journey. This must be so hard.
Helen skittered her fingers along the window blinds, peeking through the dust-laced slats.
There's a lot I'm trying to figure out now, like that girl of his.
Katie looked over at her.
He always had a weakness for girls like that,
Helen continued.
Handfuls. I'd only met her twice, but I don't think Ryan was too serious about her.
Katie hesitated, then finally said, They were pretty serious. I heard he'd bought her an engagement ring. Helen's head jerked up. Then after a pause, she sank down to the mattress, laughing a little, a kind of laughing.
Isn't it a strange day, she said, when you realize you have no idea what's going on in your kid's head. One morning you wake up and there's this alien in your house. They look like your kid, sound a little like them, but they are not your kid. There's something else that you don't know. And they keep changing. They never stop changing on you.
Katie almost said something but stopped herself. She didn't want to be one of those smug parents like Gwen, like Molly, who claimed to read their daughter's expressions with 100% accuracy. But she could. The particular twist of Devon's mouth that meant frustration, the shake of her elbow that meant her wrist was throbbing, the twitch over her left eye that meant she was afraid.
I can't imagine what you're going through, Katie said instead, touching the window blinds, warm in the sun. Losing your... You keep losing them nonstop, don't you? Helen said. Where'd you get that idea anyway, about the ring?
Someone saw him at Ahi Jewelers the week before. Helen shook her head.
Ah, well, Katie, I don't see him buying any ring. He couldn't pay his water bill. He didn't even have a credit card.
Oh, Katie said, not sure what else to say, not sure why she was here. She peeped through the bedroom door, checking on Drew, his tiny head behind the sofa back, those little ears red as Swedish fish. Behind her, Helen was sliding open the closet door, a waft of fabric softener and old smoke. Bending down, she lifted something off the floor.
Here, she said, handing it to Katie. Here's why I asked you to come.
It was a vinyl gym sack Katie recognized, dimly. One of those tournament giveaways a few months back. Gingerly, she slit its pull string. The room dark, the navy bag dark, she couldn't see anything except a flash of red. Her hand inside, the familiar feel of Lycra. A leotard. A competition one. Red and black with a swirl scoop neck, a spray of crystals up one shoulder. They'd paid extra for the crystals. Eric said it would be worth it. The light would pick up the sparkle. Katie hadn't seen it since the charity invitational in Inverness 6 weeks ago. They'd played Eye of the Tiger when she came out on the floor to take her medal. She looked inside the neck hole, and there it was. D. Knox. The same iron-on label she used with all Devon's travel leotards. She held it for a second. Something sick in her stomach. Helen's fingers appeared on its edges, lifting it so the light caught it. And Katie could see the slight tear in the seam at the crotch, and then, turning it, a pale, scaly stain on the back. Her stomach turned hotly, hand slapping over her mouth.
What did he do?
Her voice thundered from her, surprising her.
No,
Helen said loudly to match Katie's sudden loudness.
That's not what this is.
I know what I'm seeing, said Katie, trying to control herself, but her voice whirling and worrying.
You know Ryan.
I don't know him. The words came out in sharp sputters. Except I know that he's been arrested. He had drug problems. He had a violent girlfriend. That's what I know. And now I know he did something to my daughter. Helen reached out and touched her arm lightly.
Listen, listen, she said. No one likes to imagine their daughter's been...
Stop it, Katie said. Or heard herself say, her face crowding with heat.
Stop it! I know my daughter. And I know Ryan, Helen said, grabbing the leotard from Katie's hands and turning it so Katie could see the inside.
The words written in silver Sharpie. I, heart, you,
so much. She knew the handwriting, unmistakable. And the same silver Sharpie Devon used on her notebooks, in her diary.
My son had some problems in his life, Helen was saying. With substances, with direction. But he would never hurt a woman.
Devon's not a woman, Katie said, a coldness lifting up through her body.
She's a child. She's never even had a date. This is crazy.
Helen leaned against the wall, watching the leotard dangling from Katie's fingers.
You have to decide what you want to think. What you want to know, that's on you.
But I don't think Ryan would have kept that if she hadn't meant something to him. She paused.
Everything meant a lot to him.
Have the police seen this? Katie asked, her mind clicking, ratcheting up speed.
I wanted to talk to you first, Helen said. Do you think Haley found out about the two of them?
No, Katie said quickly. No, Helen, you can't tell the police about this.
Why not?
She couldn't even think through all the reasons, or which ones mattered most.
Because, Katie said, her voice breaking humiliatingly. Think how Ryan would feel. Think about that. Everyone would find out. And everyone would know your son is a statutory rapist. Worse.
Helen lifted a hand so fast that for a crazy second Katie thought she might hit her. But instead she covered her mouth with it, shaking her head.
I'm sorry, Katie said. I'm just...
She looked down at the scant leotard like a doll's costume in her hand. None of it was possible.
You're worried about your girl, Helen said with a new coldness. People thinking things about your baby girl. Getting her caught up in this.
I'm just asking for time, mom to mom. Helen nodded wearily, the back of her hand on her forehead.
No promises. But for now, okay.
Mom, she could hear Drew say from the other room. Hey, mom! I'm coming, she said, moving past Helen, the leotard clutched to her chest. The smells of the room, the way Helen's eyes looked, she had to leave.
None of you even cared about Ryan, Helen said. You just let him work for you, do things for you.
That's not true, Katie said, embarrassed to feel heat rising in her eyes.
None of us know our kids, Helen said,
reaching for the leotard in Katie's hand.
Haven't you figured that out yet?
You're no different than the rest of us.
You're wrong, something inside her said. About that, you couldn't be more wrong.
And Katie held on to the leotard. She held on so hard her nails left ugly furrows in her own skin that would last for hours. And the look on her face must have been something because Helen let go. She let go. Come on, Katie said, seeing Drew in Ryan's kitchen, standing in front of the refrigerator. Now.
But look!
He was pointing to a photo taped on the fridge door, a blur of greenery. Stippling moss, the muddy colors of a bad computer printer. No time for nature. Okay, kiddo?
Okay.
Standing at the dining room table, the lulling zip-zap from Drew's cartoons in the other room, she punched at her phone. First she called Eric, then Devon, then Eric again. No one was answering anywhere, and she had no idea what words would come if someone did answer. For a very brief moment she tried to sit still. Devon's room was hot, always hot, all that energy. It stayed there. Katie hovered in the doorway a long minute, taking in all the symmetry and order. The organization so precise it felt mysterious. To Katie, her life always brim-high with chaos and distraction, Devon's order was a mystery. And for the first time, it felt suspect.
Will it still be there?
She wondered. In the same cramped spot she'd found it the first time, 2 years ago, and again in February, the day after Devon got her first period. On all fours on the bed, she reached down into the wood's swollen crevice between the bookshelf and mattress in the upper left corner, feeling for the diary, fat and weighty, its felt fabric cover, I heart everything. But her hand had only cardboard, a box, and another. She lifted them out, four of them. Four cardboard boxes of tampons, one for every month.
Katie had bought them all for her, and now they were wedged between her mattress and the wall, unopened except the first box, all its tampons lined up like soldiers, save one empty spot, for the tampon she'd handed her daughter. Katie felt herself grow dizzy, collapsing slightly on the bed. But what about the diary entry she'd read? She tried to remember it, something about becoming a woman and that it hadn't hurt, and had she said it had been beautiful? Pieces hurtling into place, it now seemed so clear. Devon hadn't been writing about her first period. She'd never even had her period. She was writing about Ryan. Her first time with Ryan, scarlet marking the spot on the leotard Katie found in the wash. "No one ever tells you there'll be so much blood," Devon had said to Katie as they lay together on Katie's bed. Her daughter deceiving her. Lies upon lies. "I made it happen," she said. "And now it's forever." And two, "Don't tell Dad. Mom, don't tell Dad." Katie tripped down the hall to the bathroom, leaning over the toilet, sure she'd be sick, she waited. Then stood again, staring into the vanity mirror, her hand over her mouth. Chapter 14. Face fretted from the sun and years of fishing and puttering in his widower's yard, he was the only neighbor still there since they first moved in. He'd been there for Devon's accident, for Devon's earliest backyard tumbling efforts. "That trampoline sure looks fun," he'd said, watching Eric install it. "But you might want to put some shock absorbers over those springs." For the time, the Gazette came to take pictures of Devon swinging from the walnut tree's branch. "Mr. Watts?" she asked, glancing at her watch. "Can you keep an eye on Drew for a little while?" He straightened, looking at Drew. "I swear he stopped being contagious 2 days ago."
"Had scarlatina when I was a kid back in the 50s, he said. "Out of school for a month. Read all the Hardy Boys stories. My favorite was The Melted Coins. A crazy sailor tries to tattoo Joe. That seemed much worse than hives."
"What is it I plan to do?" she asked herself over and over on the 45-minute drive. "Where do I even begin?" She wondered what Haley knew. Had she found out about Ryan and Devon and then, with that same spike-rattling jealousy that had sent her to Devon's muscled throat, done something appalling? An old country road, her purple bug of a car, a luscious grape darting from the darkness and straight into her cheating lover.
A red swarm of tracksuits were gathering at the gym's double doors, a few girls peering in the windows, the rest squirming and bouncing.
Seeing them all in the brightness of the afternoon, out there in the wild, free from the carapace of glass and insulation and mats and padding and foam, Katie was struck. Everything looked vivid and strange. They were massing, half of them as brawny as footballers, their necks and waists thickened by muscle, the other half as delicate as sylphs, girls who seemed to consume only air, chalk dust, chestless chests, and the round behinds. The few with breasts seemed to treat them as vestigial burdens, their arms folded across them, their zippers pulled high above them. It was as if Katie were wearing glasses for the first time in her life, the world suddenly brought into sharp focus. The 11- and 12-year-olds bundled at the windows, jaws locked. Veins roped across temples, corded up the neck, they reminded her of baby birds, their heads tilted back, gullets unhinged, open, cries shrill and hungry for anything. Then there were the older ones, 15, 16, 17. They were looking at their phones, or their moms, these hardened vets, biceps fist-thick, straight lines down to thighs, powerful enough to anchor the world, none of them topping 5'3". "See what it does to them?" a comment Katie overheard once. A parent at Devon's school watching Devon walk across the parking lot.
"Check out Popeye,"
Katie had heard a man say at the mall, winking at his friend.
"Too bad those are pecs, not tits."
Devon, whose toes pointed out as she slept, whose ankles cracked as she walked up the stairs, who, before she performed, would one by one crack all her joints, fingers, knuckles, neck, toes, hips, and ankles, pulling her thumbs so far back they rested on her wrists like tongues. Once she had to take Devon for an EKG, and the nurse kept telling her,
Relax all your muscles. And Devon kept saying, I am, I am. She looked down at Devon's pointed toes, hard as screws, like a ballerina, like a Chinese princess. Now, before the bolted Bellstar's entrance, here was 5-year-old Ashley Hargrove, cracking her spine into a backbend, her tiny body like a table, shoulders pushed out over her hands. It came to Katie, that feeling, one she had known before, but it was so much stronger now, a nagging sense of some irrevocable wrong. What have we done to them? What have I done? Always there, like a flicker in the corner of her eye. She'd learned to ignore it, but now it was quite suddenly right in front of her. It was everywhere. She shut her eyes.
Katie? Katie, where's Eric? Does he know about this?
Becca Plonsky said, her hands pressing down on little Dominique's shoulders.
Can you call Eric?
Everyone was assembled around the handwritten sign on the door. Gym closed today. No practice until further notice. The management.
What do we do?
Cheyenne Chu asked. Her elfin fingers touched the sign as if it might give her a deeper knowledge.
What do we do?
He might have given us some warning, Kirsten Seifert said, chewing gum forcefully. I cut a conference call short to get Jordan here.
Unacceptable, whispered Becca just under her breath. This is completely unacceptable.
Even if Teddy can't be here, Kirsten said more loudly, does that mean the gym can't run? We paid for that staff. We pay for those lights to be on.
Katie didn't say anything, scanning the crowd for Devon. Devon, whom she hadn't seen in 3 days. She felt a hand on her arm. Turning around, she saw the strained face of Molly Chu.
I didn't think I'd see you here, she said. So, where's she getting her private lessons?
Katie stared at her a moment.
What do you mean? Come on. No one believes the scarlet fever thing and Haley's locked up, so why else would Devon keep missing practice?
Then, moving closer to Katie, lowering her voice.
But listen, don't be greedy. Just give me the coach's name. I don't want Cheyenne to lose the month before qualifiers either.
Wait, Katie said. Are you saying Devon hasn't been at practice? Molly scratched her brow nervously, just like Cheyenne on the beam, her torso shaking. Which was why Cheyenne would never go elite. Molly wouldn't say another word until they were nearly to Katie's car, Cheyenne gazing after them forlornly, shivering in her nylon shorts by the gym's doorway.
She hasn't been to practice for the last 3 days,
Molly whispered, even though they were yards away from anyone.
Oh. Neither has Lacey, by the way. People were guessing Gwen had a private coach for her. Do you think so? What does Eric say?
She's been staying with Gwen, Katie said. Devon has.
Molly's face stiffened and she paused, as if calculating something.
I'm sure it's a misunderstanding.
I don't think so, Katie said, quick and pointed.
Well, it's not like Gwen kidnapped her.
Molly, you're telling me you haven't heard anything at all? You talk to Gwen 12 times a day, all of you do.
All of who?
Molly said, tilting her head.
The booster clatch.
Molly looked at her, blinking.
I've told you what I know,
she said, her voice newly clipped.
And aren't you part of the so-called booster clatch? Don't we all want the same thing? No practice, not even open gym. This close to qualifiers is inexcusable.
I don't care about that right now, Katie said, her own voice sounding so insistent, grinding up her throat. I care about my daughter. I'm trying to find out why my daughter's not here.
But something in Molly's face had changed. A veil, a mask dropped over it.
We all know Devon's the big gold dream, she said coolly. But there are other gymnasts here, too. Other girls count, too.
Katie recognized the tone. From school events, the college fair, the Mother's Day fashion show. The other parents, their under-the-breath comments, the looks they exchanged if Katie or Eric asked a question. It only demonstrated how distinct and special Devon was.
Long ago, she'd learned. Eric had shown her. You had to own it.
Well, Katie said, finally, jaw set, voice steady. Only one counts to me. The man in the God's Little Acre polo shirt and cap pushed the neon yellow machine across the lawn, punching holes in the spongy grass. He was whistling as she walked swiftly past him, up the long curving drive studded with sacks of peat moss. Punch, punch, punch. Standing at the knotty pine door, she clapped the dragonfly knocker, which didn't seem to make any sound. She clapped it again. Punch, punch.
Don't think anyone's home, the lawn man called out, turning off the aerator.
The whirring stopped, the quiet swallowing everything. Somewhere a cicada thrummed. She thought she saw something move through a sliver of blurred glass at the top of the door. A flash on the front staircase. A ghost. From inside, she heard the beeping sound of an alarm system and the click of a bolt. Turning the brass knob, Katie pushed the door open. There, halfway up the spiral staircase, was little Lacey, legs matching its narrow white balusters, blending with them, as if all turned on a lathe by a master woodworker. Her hand clamped over one of the finials.
"Hi, Mrs. Knox."
One socked foot lifted and rested on the step behind her, as if she were backing away.
"Where's Devon?" Katie asked. "Sorry," she took a breath. "But where's Devon?"
Lacey's hand loosened slightly on the finial, the shape of a cannonball.
"They're gone," she said. "It's just me."
Striding past the caramel stone walls, the flagstone floors, the vaulted ceilings of the grand house, they didn't speak. Lacey, like some sly elf from a fairy tale, silently ushered her through a doorway with the sign, "Lacey's Lair," hanging over the frame. The room smelled strongly of lavender and sweet pea. On one wall, the words, "Sweet Dreams," were painted in sprawling silver cursive, the exclamation point like a crisp command. On the opposite wall, behind the satin headboard, hung a yard-high black silhouette of Lacey, that tilted nose and bulbous forehead. A series of gymnast decals leaped and bounded and somersaulted over the vanity mirror. Beneath, a small banner read in glittery ink, "Conquer Your Fears." No exclamation point. With a slightly weary wave of the hand, Lacey gestured to a button-tufted settee on which Katie was invited to sit.
"Lacey," Katie said, "you need to tell me, where's your mom? Where's Devon?"
But Lacey just stood in front of her mirrored vanity, lustered deco style like a Shirley Temple movie, and began brushing her ponytail with great care and tenderness. Watching her in the beveled mirror, Katie was suddenly struck by what an unaccountably exquisite child Lacey was. So much time watching these girls, you looked at their bodies constantly, but so rarely their faces. That white blonde hair, eyebrows that arched like a doll's painted ones, a chin that came to a sharp point, and a gap between her two front teeth that made her look vaguely amorous, even though she was only 11 and had probably never even looked at a boy.
"Honey," she tried again. "Where's Devon? You need to tell me, okay?"
The girl looked at her in the mirror, slowly setting down her hairbrush, frilled with her pale strands.
"They're not here. Grandma's coming soon," she said. "Riley left early, that's why I'm by myself. But it doesn't matter to me."
"Riley's your babysitter?"
"I don't need a babysitter,"
she said, pulling her socks off gently.
"Riley's giving me privates."
Katie looked at her.
"Beam and vault,"
Lacey added, eyes lifting. "Ah," Katie thought, realizing.
"How long have you been getting private lessons?"
Lacey swirled her finger across the back of the hairbrush and said nothing. "And Devon?" Lacey's fingers danced over to the vanity's glass knobs, one hand on each side of the vanity, twisting them.
"Lacey, did your mom and Devon go on a trip today?"
Lacey looked down at her bare, gnarled feet and lifted them, tiptoeing. The gesture was so Devon-like that Katie felt a rush of pity.
"Lacey," she said, leaning forward on the settee, "I'm sorry they left you by yourself. It isn't very nice. Do you,
They left you too, Lacey said. Didn't they?
She turned slowly to face Katie.
They're at Empower, which is far away. Mom takes Devin there for her privates. Mr. Ellers thinks he can turn things around for her.
It's Coach T's fault Devin didn't make junior elite. Coach T can't even control his own family.
That's what they said. I heard them.
Katie shifted, her fingernails snagging on the tufted cushion.
Heard who?
Mom and Devin and Mr. Knox. They were all talking on the terrace this morning.
She pointed to her window.
You can hear everything people say out there. That's where my mom goes to yell on the phone.
Mr. Knox? The smell in the room, the lavender, the feeling of the cushion beneath her tearing. Lacey? Has he been here before? Since Devin came?
No,
she said, lifting her brush again.
But he was here this morning. And then Mom went inside and left Devin and him alone. He was crying.
What? What did you say?
I didn't hear him, but Devin kept saying, Dad, 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 don't cry.
Katie felt her fingernails gouge into the tuft and rip loose. The only time she'd ever seen Eric cry was the accident, Devin's accident. Lacey's head lifted. She looked at Katie in the mirror.
My dad used to cry,
she said.
When he came to pick me up on weekends, my mom made him stay in his car until he pulled himself together. Do you cry?
Katie clenched her hand, tucking her wounded finger in the center. Everybody cries, Lacey. Lacey looked at her dubiously.
I wondered if it was just Dad's,
she said.
Mr. Knox, he kept saying he was sorry.
Katie felt something small and delicate unhook inside her.
Sorry about what?
Lacey shrugged, looking at Katie in the mirror. Sorry about what? What?
Blood,
Lacey said, turning.
What?
And they both looked down at the settee, its lilac satin, daubed red. Lifting her hand, staring at her shorn nail, its red tip, Katie found herself almost laughing. Lacey walked her to the front door, her elven feet now in flip-flops that gently slapped the stone floors, the sound echoing into the distant rafters like wings.
Is Haley in a mental hospital?
She asked.
Not exactly, Katie said. Lacey, what if you called your mom for me?
Why don't you call her?
I have. She isn't answering. Maybe if you called...
Lacey looked at her, her fingers dancing up to the security panel on the wall.
I texted her,
she said,
when you got here, so she already knows.
Katie wondered if, behind her aura of mute surrender, the stupor of her eyes like a drugged pixie, Lacey knew more about her mother and everything than anyone guessed.
She just leaves you alone with Riley? Does she know him well?
Katie blurted, not sure where it came from or why she was saying it.
Riley's a girl,
Lacey said.
I already have a boyfriend.
You do?
We met at the county invitational. He works concessions. He has long sideburns and the keys to all the rooms at Lightning City.
Those pointy brows like butterfly antennae, and the stoned lips, numb and pink-jutted. Lacey, when you say boyfriend, what does he...
He has a big key ring, and he said he'll take me on a tour, but not till I'm in high school.
Katie squinted, trying to be sure she was understanding.
Don't tell my mom, okay?
Lacey was saying, her head tilted against the front door.
About my boyfriend.
A crush of questions pushed into Katie's brain, all for this candy sticklet of a girl. But before Katie could ask them, the front door had opened, the beeps of the security system announcing Katie's departure.
Mom says if a man ever touches me,
Lacey said,
she'll definitely kill him.
The door shutting behind her, the smell of sweet pea dancing behind her, and then gone. Katie sat in her car for a long time. There were two missed calls from Eric, prompted by Gwen, she was sure.
"I know what you did," she said to his voicemail. "How could you? You'd better be driving home with my daughter right now. I know everything."
And she wasn't even sure what she meant by everything. It felt like the biggest word in the world. It felt like a black hole. Pulling up the drive, she saw the garage door was open, gaping before her, a big ragged mouth. Inside, Mr. Watts stood with Drew in the back corner next to a snare of rakes and brooms, the rust-furred real lawnmower, the only one they'd owned since Devin's accident. Long ago, Eric had taken a sledgehammer to the old one, sending sparks across the lawn, a figure eight of singed grass. Even this one, its blades looking so sharp.
"Mom, we were looking for the shovel,"
Drew said as she got out of the car and walked toward them.
"In the book, they dig up a buried treasure."
"Hardy boys,"
Mr. Watts said, gesturing toward the worn volume Drew had set on the garage floor.
"Melted coins. He can keep it."
"And look what we found,"
Drew held out his hand.
"On the ground."
She looked in his outstretched palm, cherried and tender. In the center sat a trio of silver wafers, one as large as a dime, the other two almost too small to see. Katie cupped Drew's hand in her own, eyes still on the silver, like the paint in a model plane kit.
"He thought they were silverfish," Mr. Watts said.
"Not once I got closer,"
Drew insisted, looking down at the concrete floor as if expecting to see more.
"There was no antenna or anything."
"Paint chips," Mr. Watts said. "Must have come off your car."
"Dad's car,"
Drew said.
"Mom's is blue."
She could feel Mr. Watts looking at her, Drew waiting for her. But her brain stuttered, stalled.
"Anyway," Mr. Watts said, clearing his throat, "we had an adventure."
Her phone, like a praying animal, one eye lifted, blinked with texts from Eric.
"Please, I can explain."
"Get home now," she typed. It was the sole corner in the house without booster flyers and spreadsheets, without gym grips and tape and everything coated in chalk.
"I hope I get to go outside soon," Drew said,
his cheek pressed against his window screen.
"Not just the garage."
"You will, honey. Open the window."
"Look,"
he said, pointing to the black walnut tree outside. She was grateful for any distraction. "The catkins," she said. "You used to say they looked like demon fingers." They'd chosen the house in part because of the dark canopy of the walnut tree. When they first came to see it nearly 15 years ago, Katie asked the man rolling a sod cutter next door, their future neighbor, Mr. Watts, what all the long green frills drooping from the branches were. They looked like flower lays.
"Happens every spring," Mr. Watts had said. "You like them now, but just you wait."
Later she'd realized what he meant, the way the catkins fell in soft heaps to the ground and turned brown and black. Banana peel clumps, Devin called them. It turned out there was a chemical in the tree's roots that stunted or poisoned everything around it. The petunias Katie once planted there shriveled to pale ribbons. But Katie still loved the way they carpeted the lawn, had loved running and swinging little Devin's feet through their velvet tendrils, the pollen staining their ankles. And Drew loved them, too. Every fall he'd take pictures of the silky webworm nests that hung from the branch ends. He said they looked like his favorite teacher's hair.
"Those catkins, they're wonderful," Eric used to tease her. "Wonderful tarantulas."
And then he'd mentioned how they used the wood to make gun stocks and coffins.
"That's what old man Watts told me," he said. "Makes me wonder what happened to Mrs. Watts."
"Mom,"
Drew said now, pointing out the window.
"Mrs. Teether says those are bagworms."
Rising, Katie followed his gaze to the odd, lumpy sacks dotting the branches.
"Thackeray brought one into class," Drew said. "The boy worms leave the bag when they want a mate. The girls never leave at all. They don't have wings or legs or mouth parts. The girls die in there."
"Always harder on the girls, huh?"
but just one female can make 1,000 babies.
That's some mom, she said, chin on the top of his head, peering out.
Supermom. They ate the whole tree.
That's not good. She tried to smile, but the bags looked ominous, alive, almost like something was kicking inside.
Not good at all.
Drew looked at her, nodding.
Mom?
Yes, Drew? The bags were rocking, the wind kicking up. She imagined she could see the eggs inside, white as slugs.
You have to kill her.
And Katie found herself nodding, too.
You had to stop them, just like the tent caterpillars in the crabapple tree at one of the apartment buildings she'd lived in as a kid. The landlord had burned them with kerosene.
Mom?
Drew was saying. Rushing down the hall, she thought she heard a phone ringing somewhere. She was trying to think if they had any lighter fluid. Then she remembered something. Grabbing for her purse in the hallway, she pulled something from it.
Stay inside, she shouted to Drew from the bottom of the stairs.
Mom,
he said, leaning over the railing.
You look funny.
It felt good in her hands, like a sword. She hoisted the tiki torch from the sand bucket on the patio. The heat-splintered one she'd brought home from the tiki party a few months ago. There was a feeling inside her that was tangled and wretched, and she peered up to Drew's window while she poured the glugging fuel from the can in the garage. Dirty sacks strung along the branches like miniature party lanterns, just inches from her son's window, her stricken son. They were everywhere, and she couldn't fathom how she hadn't seen them before. One mass nestled in the crotch of the tree was so large it resembled a small animal spread-eagled under gauze, limbs splaying against branches. A horror show. Others hung in the joints like Christmas balls tinted brown. All this time? How long? They'd been here in her backyard, her patio, where all the boosters had perched just a few days ago. Once she saw one, she saw 100, and her chest felt full and large. Waving the torch, the smell heavy and sweet, she swooped its embered end across the woolly pouches. A husk skittered from the branch, sparking hot into her hair before she jumped away, cinders scattering. Looking up, she could see Drew's face in his bedroom window, eyes wide as the flaming pods dropped and as one of the branches caught fire.
"Stay inside," she shouted. "Don't you move, honey. It's not safe out here."
The torch in her hands, saber or bayonet, she kept going until she'd vanquished them all. It was only then, standing behind the tree so Drew couldn't possibly see, that she tossed the item around her arm into the fire. That red and black leotard snatched from her purse, its spray of crystals popping like small firecrackers, the lycra collapsing slowly into soft black gum. Looking up again, she caught sight of the tree itself, an enormous inflamed torch. The wind kicked up higher, and her panic was a feeling more expected than experienced. There wasn't time, the flames stripping up the dark bark.
"The tree's on fire," someone said.
In the same second, she heard a squeaking sound, and then the splash of cool striking her arm, skating up the tree, sizzling a moment, then trampling the flames. Mr. Watts, turning the wheel on his garden hose. The smell was strong, and they both held their shirts up over nose and mouth. Looking up, Mr. Watts waved at Drew, who was still watching closely from his window, his red face abraded by the screen. The ground littered with blackening pouches, all hissing and popping. Katie began raking the tiki torch around and circling them.
"Next time, give a holler," he said to Katie. "We can snip 'em down first. That way you don't lose the whole tree. Don't take any houses with you, either."
"No," she said, shaking her head. She was not herself, heat glazing her, making her feel invincible. "How could you ever be sure you got them all?" He nodded, catching one last ember with a stray sluice of water left in the hose.
"When they cool down," Mr. Watts said, "I'll take them off your hands."
She looked at him quizzically.
"Fish bait," he said, winking at her. "The cycle of life."
Together they watched all of them burn, like singed cotton candy. Later, Katie would sneak back into the yard,
knees to dirt, palms on ground until she found the last bits of gummy lycra, a few crystals seared into the flattened grass. Chapter 15. It was nearly 10 o'clock, and she'd let Drew stay up so long his eyes stung to tears from too much TV, and his words were beginning to break apart and float away. He kept finding shows that seemed to come from some special planet of Drew, creepy reruns of In Search Of, a documentary about hairless, blue-eyed, and hunchbacked creatures killing livestock in Texas, another about the mysterious red rain of Sri Lanka. They all interested him and made him wonder about things, his speckled face, and the softness of his boy tummy as he stretched across the cushions. She could sit there and watch him and not think of anything else, not think about leotards or pixie nymphettes or dark-eyed men and the lies they tell you, or the silver paint in the garage which shimmered every time she shut her eyes and which meant nothing, couldn't mean anything. Instead, listening, her entire body flooded with love for Drew, his voice creaking forth question after question, each one a balm to her.
"Mom,"
he said, his Hardy Boys book open on his lap.
"It says here, Blackbeard used to stick matches in his beard to light up his evil eyes."
"That sounds scary," she said.
"That sounds like a scary book."
Eventually he started drifting off, curled like a glowworm, in his neon green pajamas on the sofa beside her, and she half coaxed, half carried him to bed. Looking into those nearly lidded eyes, the gleam of his pupil trying to stay awake, not to miss anything, she found herself locked in something deep with him, like he held something she needed.
"Don't fall asleep, Drew, please."
She caught herself thinking it, maybe saying it out loud, her fingers to her own lips. Embarrassed, she shook it off, rising from his bedside and nearly bounding to the bedroom door, leaving him alone. The 11 o'clock news was beginning, its familiar pulsing music. Behind it, she heard the groan of the garage door. They almost always left it open, but she'd closed it so she would know when he returned. And so he would know she knew. Then the loud punch and scatter of glass breaking in the backyard. The scrape of metal on concrete. Hands smacking the screen door open, the thickening June air climbing into her mouth, Katie called out, "Who's there?" He was slouched in the most ramshackle of their aluminum chairs, a half-hollowed pint of Jack Daniel in his hand, a beer bottle broken at his feet, and the back of his neck ruddy from a day spent behind a car windshield, kidnapping her daughter and driving her across the state with another woman. His face shimmered forth in the dark, tanner than the day before, the grand slope of his eyes sorrowful. Handsome as ever, maybe more. So much so he took her breath away, and she felt sick from it.
"Eric, I'm gone a few hours and you set the backyard on fire," he said, not looking at her, his feet kicking at the ashes.
"Where's Devin?" she demanded.
"Where is she, Eric?"
When he turned, head bobbing slightly, she could see how drunk he was. Like she hadn't seen him in years, like he'd sometimes been when Devin was a baby and he was still rollicking with co-workers at the end of his long days. His after-hours spent with elbows stuck to placemats at their local, a place called Huddles, where the bartenders wore green vinyl aprons and drank while they poured, and Eric staying until last call, finally stumbling home at 3 a.m., shoes sticky and hair matted, and once a dart caught in his finger. He'd driven home with blood soaking through the cuff of his work shirt, and sorry, sorry, sorries forever.
"Where's Devin?"
she repeated, standing in front of him, the caramel smell of the whiskey thick upon her.
"Where is she?"
"At Gwen's."
"Why is she still there?" "God damn it! Eric, you lied!"
"So you know," he said. "Your message. You know everything."
She looked at him, a breeze lifting the smell of the ash, the waving torch. He looked at her eyes, white as an animal's in the woods. They each waited, a marital standoff, the silence unbearable. But she blinked first.
How could you go meet John Ellers at his fancy empowered gym with our daughter and not tell me?
Her voice bouncing around the weird dark of the yard.